It's been the face of Irish nationalism, and now for the first time, Sinn Féin has won the largest number of seats in Northern Ireland's parliament. But what's behind this political shift, and what does it mean for the future of the United Kingdom? I'm Nastasia Tay, and you're listening to the Inside Story podcast, where we dissect, analyse, and help define major global stories. Well, let's now bring in our guests. In Belfast, we have Duncan Morrow. He's a professor of politics at Ulster University. In Brussels, Nicholas White, an international affairs strategist and senior director in Brussels for APCO, that's a public affairs and strategic consultancy. And in Cambridge, Graham Gudgeon, a research associate at the University of Cambridge, and also a former special advisor to First Minister David Trimble in the Northern Ireland Assembly. A warm welcome to each of you. Thank you so much for joining us, gentlemen. Now, I want to start with why this is such a significant development. These are regional elections. Polls like this don't necessarily always make the headlines of international news. But party support in Northern Ireland really has potentially existential consequences here. So, looking at the design of Northern Ireland's very institutions, it was predicated on this idea, the outcome of this very protracted peace process. I'm curious, Duncan, do you think the Good Friday Agreement could have predicted this?
Well, in some senses, the Good Friday Agreement is an electoral situation in which people go for, if you like, election, and anything can happen. At another level, I think the presumption was that by this stage, the border issue, if at least, would be much quieter, and that there wouldn't be the same level of tension. And we've seen an inflammation of that question again in the last 4 or 5 years since the Brexit referendum. And I think that this result is a complex one, because at one level, it doesn't change anything. The balance of power between the different groups in Northern Ireland hasn't changed dramatically, except that there's a much bigger centrist group in the middle who belongs to neither of them was there before. But what has happened is that in our situation where two groups have to be together in the top office, the First and Deputy First Minister, the nominations have swapped. It used to be the Unionists used to take the First Minister post, and now it's Sinn Féin. And where that is interesting, I suppose, is in the fact that Sinn Féin can at least claim that here's the party which exists to get rid of Northern Ireland, is now the largest party in Northern Ireland. And for the Unionists, they find themselves as the deputy. But in real terms, it doesn't actually make as much difference as it looks symbolically.
We'll get to some of the practical implications in just a minute. But Nicholas, I want to ask you, because there is an enormous amount of symbolism here. The fact that the party that was once the political wing of the IRA is now in line to actually appoint the First Minister, the fact that the First Minister could be a Catholic, did that play a part in driving votes?
Well, clearly it made a very important difference to Sinn Féin's campaign, the idea that there was a chance that by voting for Sinn Féin, you could have a First Minister from the nationalist side, I think was a very strongly motivating factor. And in fact, I think the DUP made a mistake here because they tried to campaign against it. And I think that nationalist voters perhaps felt more strongly about it than the DUP's own target voters, because the DUP's vote went down and Sinn Féin's went up. But we also have to bear in mind that there's a comparative aspect here. Scotland for years has been run by the Scottish National Party, whose job it is to break up the United Kingdom and create an independent Scottish state. They still haven't succeeded in doing it, but they have succeeded in governing Scotland.
Graham, I'll bring you in here, because as Nicholas just alluded to there, a vote for the DUP used to be a vote to keep Sinn Féin out of government. Now we've seen this huge shift in the political landscape, a huge growth, as we were saying earlier, in the centre. I see the Alliance Party won 17 seats, so that's up from 8 in 2017, and 13.5% of first preference votes. Are we, in a sense, seeing a normalisation of Irish politics?
To a slight extent, I think, but we shouldn't exaggerate it. I mean, the Alliance is only getting 13%. And we don't know that this is really a long-term trend. Alliance tends to be a party that gets protest votes, you know, from people who are temporarily disaffected from the main parties. So it's maybe a cyclical thing, but or it may be a long-term structural change. I rather suspect that it is. I think there are quite a lot of young professionals, both Catholic and Protestant, in Northern Ireland who just get fed up of what they see as the main parties banging on either about staying in the Union or Irish unity. And they'd rather if they would concentrate on more bread and butter issues. especially people who've got young families and they're interested in education, they're interested in health, health issues. So to some extent that's happening, but we shouldn't forget that Northern Ireland politics is basically a zero-sum game. Northern Ireland either stays in the United Kingdom or it joins the Republic of Ireland. It's one or the other. It can't do both. You know, it can't be in the UK on weekdays and the Irish Republic at weekends or something of that sort. So the alliance's position is not really a very strong or fundamental one, but it's a satisfactory, quite nice place for non-aligned voters who don't want to see themselves as extremists to be.
Sure. Let me throw that back to you then, Nicholas. Do you think, given the change that we're seeing in the electorate here, a move towards the middle, is this a move away then from sectarianism?
It is. Of course, the result of that is that the sectarian parties that represent unionists or nationalists then themselves become somewhat more hardline. But anecdotally, the growth in the centre ground has been latent for a long time. Many people in Northern Ireland are in mixed relationships. Their spouse or their partner is from the other tradition to them. Yeah. And the traditional parties don't have anything to offer families in that situation. And in particular, they don't have anything to offer the children of parents who are from different traditions. And that's been a very much a growing part of the community. It's certainly not a majority, but it's a growing part. Up until recently, those people would probably not have voted at all. And now they are voting, and they're voting for the Alliance Party to a much lesser extent for other centrist parties. Mm-hmm. And that I think is the situation that the framework where you started your very first question, Nastasia, was about whether the structures of the Good Friday Agreement are robust enough to accept this sort of this change of paradigm. I think that's a very good question, and I don't think we have the answer.
Duncan, you alluded there to the fact that Sinn Féin didn't actually make huge gains. Their share of the vote rose only a little, didn't gain any seats. But what really led to the outcome that we're seeing was this real decline for the DUP. In your mind, what's actually led to that?
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on here. I mean, certainly my impression from Belfast is that among under 40s, the issues have changed. When I was growing up, there was a much clearer line between, if you like, Sinn Féin, who at that stage were closely associated with the IRA, and the constitutional parties. I think for people under 40, I've really noticed not just that they come from relationships that go across the divide, but that key issues have turned into social issues, such as gay marriage, such as green issues and so on. And in many ways, the unionists are isolated within that. They've had to use a special mechanism in our parliament to veto things on those kind of issues. And I think that has been underestimated as a driver for younger voters into what might be called the alliance position. And just one other thing to say there is that I think that group of people who are voting central now were actually comfortable with some of the outcomes of the Good Friday Agreement. In other words, open borders in all directions. Mm-hmm. And they were really driven. The velocity in the centrist vote has happened absolutely, in my view, connected to the consequences of the choices around hard borders and very strong preference from that group to try and keep borders open as far as possible.
Well, let's then talk about Brexit. I see in the Assembly elections in May 2016, now that was just a month before the Brexit referendum, the DUP took 29% of the vote, and this time it got 21%. And of course, when the UK left the EU, it took Northern Ireland with it. And I want to take a look at the practical implications of that. Now, that led to the creation of the Northern Ireland Protocol, which allows trucks to deliver goods without border checks when they cross from Northern Ireland into the Republic of Ireland, which remains in the EU. It was agreed that inspections would take place between Northern Ireland and mainland Britain. But critics say that effectively creates a new trade border in the Irish Sea, and unionists insist it undermines Northern Ireland's place within the UK. The protocol also protects the 1998 Good Friday Agreement, which includes the sensitive issue of removing all visible signs of a border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. Now, Graham, in your mind, how much did Brexit and the Northern Ireland Protocol actually affect the outcome of this election?
Well, it has affected it. I mean, the protocol is an issue, and it's particularly an issue with the unionist parties. who very much oppose having an internal customs border within the United Kingdom. It's hard to think of many other countries that have got an internal customs border of that sort, which is a very unusual position. And of course, they fear that's a step in the direction of a united Ireland, so they feel it weakens their position. And it undermines the Good Friday Agreement. Good Friday Agreement was based on the idea that both sides would have a check. They could stop radical changes proposed by the other side. And what's happened here is the EU has come in with a protocol and driven what Lord David Trimble calls a coach and horses through the Good Friday Agreement by not allowing that check mechanism. Even in 4 years' time, that form of check isn't there. So the protocol is affecting it. But it's important, I think, as Duncan Morrow was suggesting at the beginning, that the election results here aren't very much of a change. Sinn Féin has become the largest party, not because it's got any extra votes, but because the DUP has shed votes to an even more pro-union party, the true unionist voice, the TUV. And if you add those votes together, they come very close to Sinn Féin's votes. So there's a bit of fragmentation of the votes on the unionist side, and even that doesn't matter too much in a PR type election that we have in Northern Ireland. So not so much has changed. There's a lot of overexcitement about this in the national and international media. But I think as Duncan was suggesting, that the changes in this election are rather marginal.
Still, though, we're now looking at a potential protracted stalemate, as I understand it. The Northern Ireland secretary is in Stormont meeting the parties, and there's huge disagreement about the protocol. I see members of the DUP holding strong, saying things like, either the secretary of state wants an executive or a protocol, he can't have both. They're currently refusing to nominate ministers to the executive. And I see there's already been a threat from the British Home Secretary about trying to fix the protocol. Nicholas, after 6 years of trying, they haven't managed to fix the protocol. So what are the chances of actually finding something acceptable now, do you think?
Yeah, we have two different political dynamics here, which are interacting very unhelpfully. The first is, frankly, the need of the British government to find a reason to fight with the EU. And the protocol is, as far as I can tell, sitting in Brussels, being used purely artificially for that purpose. The landing zone diplomatically for the protocol is very clear. It's been quite clearly laid out in discussions between both sides 6 months ago, longer perhaps. So the fact that no agreement has yet been reached is quite simply a political choice by British diplomats, British officials doing the negotiations. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is the effect on Northern Irish politics. Mm. And here I really do have to disagree with Graham, I'm afraid. I think the election results are very significant. I think the fall in support for the DUP is precisely because they did not do a good job of politics around the protocol. They had the possibility to bring in a better agreement, which Theresa May negotiated. Instead, they chose to torpedo it and to trust Boris Johnson, who then came up with the protocol that they now say they don't like. And it's true, of course, that the DUP vote, which went to the TUV, the more hardline TUV, that is an anti-protocol vote. The TUV were only able to elect one member out of 90 in the Assembly, despite getting quite a lot of votes. Nobody likes this position. Nobody is going to transfer votes to it. So I think it's proved rather a vote loser for the DUP. It's been a series of mistakes, and this is the latest of them. And I think it's a real mistake to hold hostage the formation of the government of Northern Ireland over the issue of the protocol, which is an issue that the government of Northern Ireland actually has no formal influence over.
Duncan, I'll bring you in here. I see you nodding. I'm curious as well if you think this is going to potentially further conflict, not only in Northern Ireland, but also between Westminster and Brussels.
Well, it inevitably will. And I think that the conflict over the protocol has been, and over Brexit, has been latent since the Brexit referendum. The bottom line is that the United Kingdom voted to leave, but Northern Ireland voted to remain. And since then, that growth in the centrist vote has been very much a group of people who want to retain a relationship with the with the EU. I noticed last in the paper this week, it said that for the first time ever in 2020, there were more applications for Irish passports in Northern Ireland than there were for British passports. Yeah. And I think a lot of that's to do with retaining rights such as freedom of movement within the EU. And I do think that one of the lines in politics that has emerged is between this new group of centrists and unionism around the issue of the protocol. And how it's going to be resolved is very, very difficult, as Nicola said, because as he said, there are two issues interacting here, the diplomatic level where it's negotiated, but also the way in which it suggests that there's a dynamic in Northern Ireland, which is now playing its way out in the fact that we may not have a government for months.
Indeed. Graham, I'll let you respond to both of those.
Thanks very much. Nicholas's points, I think, were kind of standard Brussels position in a way, and we can perhaps understand why he's making those points. But it's ridiculous to say that the UK government is looking for a reason to oppose or upset Brussels. The UK government would like nothing more than to have this problem off their hands. But unfortunately, they can't ignore it, because now the unionists are in a position to say, look, either you have the Good Friday Agreement and its institutions, that's the Assembly and North-South, North-South institutions, or you have the protocol, but you're not getting both. So the UK government has to do something about that. What it looks like they're choosing to do is they're already working on legislation to hand power over the protocol to UK ministers. So UK ministers will then be able to override it. This will lead to a row with the EU, because the EU is showing no flexibility. What the EU did here was it exploited a period of, if I may continue, the EU exploited a period of great political weakness and division within the UK to come up with a solution with which nationalists in Northern Ireland were completely happy and unionists were completely unhappy. And in the situation of Northern Ireland, you just can't get away with that. It's unsustainable. And therefore, the protocol has to change, whether Brussels likes it or not. And
Duncan,
it will change.
Duncan, go ahead.
The difficulty that I see for Graham's position, and I don't agree with him, is that actually this election confirmed that the majority in Northern Ireland quite substantially are in favour of retaining the protocol. And if there was a vote in the Northern Ireland Assembly, it would be a majority vote. Now, I do think there is a problem that it's not shared across the community and what could be done there. The difficulty being that the form of Brexit that Boris Johnson chose also had no cross-community support, and that the options which might have had cross-community support were removed during the negotiations. So we're kind of unravelling the wheel here. I suspect that if there is an intervention which causes anything like a trade war between the European Union or anything to disrupt the open border in the south of Ireland, that it will actually cause more problems rather than less. So I'll be interested to see how it goes on. But I think to suggest that this wouldn't have wider diplomatic consequences for the UK with America and with Europe would be a mistake. And that's why I think that while they say this, the government says it will bring legislation, but doesn't actually do so.
Well, a number of countries have already come out asking for a power-sharing government to be put together as soon as possible. And I want to take a bit of a step back here, because we are in a stalemate. And I want to clarify something for our viewers that may be a little misleading. We have this First Minister position and a Deputy First Minister position, but they are essentially equal positions. So there is no government unless the DUP and Sinn Féin actually agree. Now, that all looks fairly tenuous at the moment. I see they have something like 6 months to agree on something? I mean, what happens if that doesn't actually work out, Nicholas?
Well, the legal position is clear that there will be another election. The political position, of course, is much less clear. If it's not possible to put together a government in Northern Ireland because one of the parties has got a completely detached reason for not wanting to go in, then that raises questions about whether the devolved institutions, the regional government structures established by the Good Friday Agreement, can be sustained. I think it's very dangerous for the DUP to do that from their own perspective, because the alternative to having a devolved government is going to be continued rule directly from London, with strong input from Dublin. And that is precisely the situation that was set up in 1985 under the Anglo-Irish Agreement, which the DUP found intolerable. Now they appear to be working to bring it about again. It's very strange.
Well, there's also been plenty of talk about potential reunification. Obviously, Sinn Féin has been very vocal on that. Graham, can I ask you then, how likely do you think a united Ireland is? Because despite all the speculation we've heard, I do get the sense that we're quite a long way from enough support for a move like that.
That's quite right. We're an awful long way. Polls differ a lot on how much support there is for a united Ireland inside Northern Ireland. Polls have shown differences between 25% and 45%. But I think if we say probably 30% support, we're not far wrong. Therefore, if there was a border poll, the pro-union, pro-stay in the UK faction would win by a margin of 2-1. And for that reason, of course, Sinn Féin daren't press for a border poll immediately. They're talking about a border poll perhaps within about 5 years. But this is a rolling 5 years. In 5 years, they'll still be calling for it within 5 years, because they just can't get a majority for it.
I don't want to end our discussion without asking a question which I know some of our viewers may be wondering, given the history of Ireland and what's happened on the island. Duncan, I have to ask, is there any kind of a risk here of a return to militancy, do you think?
Well, part of the issue is it can never be totally ruled out, and there's always a saber rattling on the side. I have to say, one thing I would say is that there is no support for it. There is absolutely clear that none of the political parties have gone down the road of suggesting that there should be any support for that. And there's definitely no popular support for it. But what we also know is that that's not always where it comes from. It sometimes comes from political instability, which starts something which people respond to and then escalates up. So I would say to you that it's not something that I think we should overly fear. And on the other side, the difficulty is it can never in Northern Ireland be entirely ruled out simply because there are people who are always agitating for that kind of thing.
Well, we'll keep an eye on how this all plays out, especially over the next 6 months or so. In the meantime, though, thanks to all of our guests, Duncan Morrow, Nicholas White and Graham Gudgeon. Well, that's it for the Inside Story podcast today. This episode was produced by Mohamed El Aishi, Usama Aloni, Abdurrahman Rwasame, and Jimmy Getahun. Studio sound by Nanda Kishore. The program was edited by Anil Anandan, Lynn Enwin, and Joe DeFrias. Be sure to subscribe to the Inside Story podcast to catch every episode. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back again on Tuesday.